This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
The Baton Rouge Blues Festival in Louisiana has been an annual affair for 25 years. The two-day event attracts more than 20,000 passionate fans, and as a metaphor for the community's engaged spirit, it's free of charge. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me as we visit with three passionate locals, including blues singer April Sexy Red Jackson, Maxine Crump, CEO of Dialogue on Race Louisiana, Kim Nostrum, Executive Director of the Baton Rouge Blues Festival Foundation, and Board Member Bill Bryan. We'll explore topics that include the history and definition of juke joints, the swamp blues tradition that started in Baton Rouge, and the evolution of the Baton Rouge Blues Festival and Foundation.
April Sexy Red Jackson.
I love it. So April, here we are in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Yes.
And you grew up here?
Yes, born and raised since 1970. Ooh.
Oh,
telling my age there.
Yeah. So tell us about juke joints.
Sure, sure. Well, my experience with juke joints goes a little far back, but not so far back as some of, you know, the folks that were here at the Blues Lagniappe. Given the fact of coming out sometime in the late 80s and 90s is when I had the opportunity to understand what a juke joint is. And to walk in a facility or a place that's raggedy, the lights, mostly Christmas lights, usually they're either white or red, hanging all types of ways, stuff all over the place. It looks like it hadn't had a good dusting in years. That's a juke joint to me. People laughing and talking, and as soon as you open the door, everybody turns around, hey! And then you say, hey? You know? That's a juke joint. A lot of blues, mostly blues.
And most of the juke joints are rural.
They're yes, they're way in the country. Yeah. They're off the dirt roads. They're off way off roads, especially Teddy's Juke Joint. You go out there in Zachary at night and you can't see anything, but he has this little tiny light that's flashing. But the Juke Joint is all the way off the road, way in the back. So, you know, those are the juke joints that I'm accustomed to, where they're off the rural road, they're not in the inner city, which gives you that good feel of that country down-home connection in a juke joint.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things, we were talking earlier, and I told you about my history, and I connected juke joint with its history of the jukebox.
Yes.
But then you were telling us about its West African roots of the name juke. Tell us about that.
Sure, sure. Well, with juke, the African dancers in Africa, the motions and the dances that they did to original music with hands and feet, they made juke motions. And from that, it came down to the type of music where so many people carried that music on, a juke joint, and the juke music made you juke. Okay? And a lot of people don't even realize that. I'm surprised that didn't come out tonight. But in actuality, the juke from the joint, you're juking your joints to dance to the music. Juke joint.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah. And then you said something earlier about juke boxes.
Yes.
So you had the older musicians who did the blues in the juke joints. Then as time progressed, and now you got these digital boxes now, but as time progressed and these musicians have became older, they don't come in the juke joints anymore to play and to sing. So what's left? The juke box. And in that box, especially the older ones, you can hit the Bobby Blue Bland. You can hit the Buddy Guy, B.B. King, and Muddy Waters, and all those older cats. Look, Howlin' Wolf. I went somewhere, I was like, they got Howlin' Wolf in the jukebox? Oh, my God. So these guys are long gone. Some are deceased. But when they brought in the jukebox way back, it had all those songs in it because those guys were gone. They were gone. They're not coming in the juke joints anymore. Jukebox.
I love it. Mm-hmm. I love it. Mm-hmm. But today, there still are juke joints,
yes.
And there still are local performers, right, that do
yes.
live music.
Yes, 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 there is. There's a lot of blues musicians who travel abroad, which that's one of my biggest focuses because after traveling with a production company where I opened up on a lot of venues, I was so much of doing that instead of honing into my soul, Southern soul, the blues. So now I'm like, you know, I need to start stepping into some of these older juke joints because I've been in some, but oh my God, they're all over the world. Yeah. And the good part about it is that those that love blues, love the juke joint setting, they're going to continue to go. Even though times have changed, people still like to walk into a down-home juke joint. The fried chicken and that fish grease, you know. And then you walk out and you're still smelling like fried fish and chicken. You don't know if you need to nibble on yourself or what.
Talk to us a moment about swamp blues and the roots there.
Oh, I've touched swamp blues just a little bit. I can't really tell you any big, big names, but
More of the style.
The style,
and the,
yeah.
What makes swamp blues swamp blues?
Swamp. Yeah. Well, natural, of course, they'll say some of the older historians, you had to be born in the swamp, yeah, to sing some swamp music, yeah, you know, and it's like, yeah, right. But, you know, I kind of feel like even people that were, you know, like the Chafalaya Basin, where you got a lot of Creole speaking folk that would come out and, oh, shit. Oh, we're going fish for, you know, and it's a beat, but it's blues. But it come from the swamp. And then they have that Cajun Creole sound going on. So even though you have blues, you got Creole swamp. And those that have that dialect of that Cajun Creole sound, that's how I look at swamp.
Because and how about in harmonica? Would that be
real strong?
Oh, yeah.
Harmonica is in there, too. Harmonicas are in there as well. Harmonicas, the little carachas, and, you know, all that good stuff. So,
and winding back in time, have people tried to study that pathway of how the West African song and whatnot came to the plantations and continued into the blues tradition?
Yes, yes, definitely, definitely. There are a lot of musicians that have started reaching back, okay, and sampling and taking some of that music from Africa to, you know, compile into, I've heard rap songs, I've heard Southern soul songs, I've heard pop songs, and I've even heard rock songs, okay, where they brought that African feel into the song, okay.
And part of it is beat and rhythm.
Beat and rhythm, right? And then juke, right?
Yeah.
Mhm. Mhm.
I love it. And so, you're close to your heart is singing.
Yes. Yes.
Since you were a tiny little girl, tell us about that.
Yes. Well, as far as I know, back and even, you know, with my mom telling me, you know, where and how I started, you know, thanks to her, she's the person that, you know, introduced me to blues because of all the music she had. And it was a lot of blues.
So did it get you? Did it resonate?
Yeah, because, you know, natural course, there was always the card parties. They always had domino parties. They always had a little Miller Pony. I remember that because I used to always get them and drink whatever the little corner was left
in.
Yeah. And then they'd have to pick me up and go put me in the bed. Mama let me get that little corner, you know, because it's all adults, you know. And back then, you know, kids don't sit around adults, you know. So, but even in that setting, you know, with the bead cover for the door, and I'm remembering all the stuff. She played a lot of blues. And the feeling and the movement.
Do you remember any specific performers that resonated with you as a little girl?
Little? No,
when you first connected.
When I first connected, Aretha Franklin. Aretha Franklin. And then I actually stumbled across hearing Eartha Kitt.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's timeless.
Yeah, she's timeless. So when I stumbled across hearing Eartha Kitt, then I was like, wow. And she was powerful. A little small something, but her voice was like, yeah. So definitely a lot of heavy hitters. A lot of strong singers that I've heard. Bessie Smith.
Oh, that's a timeless classic.
Yes, yes. So,
have you been to Chattanooga?
Not yet.
There's a museum there where they have a lot of her stuff. Yeah.
Okay, good. Good, I'll make sure to stop in.
Yeah. Okay, so you started singing in a church choir, right, as a young girl?
Yes, as a young child.
That's what cultivated your singing career?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. I sung in the junior choir, the young adult choir, the gospel choir, the senior choir. So I touched base with all of them. And basically, all the songs were pretty much gospel, rhythm, gospel. So that's the foundation.
But you've gone on and you have become a recording artist.
Yes, I have.
And
yes,
you
I have
a new album coming out.
Yes, yes, yes. It's called Versatile. And the reason why I named it that is because there's so many facets of what I've been singing that it's time for me to show the world I could sing the blues. I could sing the Southern Soul. I could sing the R&B. I could sing the... And you know what? Since you said it, I think I'm going to do a little swamp.
Yeah.
How's that? It's really blue.
I love it.
Oh.
Yeah. You have to keep me posted.
I will.
Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely.
Can I ask you a huge favor?
Sure.
Would you sing a little bit for me?
Sure.
Oh,
I'd be so honored.
Let's
see what I can sing for you. I will take you away with me as far as I can. To the moon and the stars. There we will love with our hands in each other's hands as we look across the ocean. Love will keep us together all the days of our lives.
Wow. April.
Are you okay?
Yeah. A little melted. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. You're so welcome. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Oh, my pleasure.
I greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure and honor. And to learn more about you?
Yes. You can actually find me on Facebook as April N. Jackson. Instagram, Red Review Entertainment, because I'm actually CEO of my own entertainment company. And you can actually find me on Google. Just type April Sexy Red. That's all you have to do.
I love it. April Sexy Red, I'm Tom Wilmer. It's been a pleasure to visit with you.
Thank you so much.
God bless.
God bless you too.
All right. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We'll see you down here.
I am Maxine Crump.
All right, Maxine, here we are in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. You were born and raised here?
Yes, I was born in Louisiana. I was born on the bayou in Maringouin, Louisiana, which is 25 miles west of Baton Rouge.
And as I recall, your parents, they owned a juke joint?
My father owned a blues club. The difference in a blues club and a juke joint is a juke joint is a place that was maybe somebody's home or something else that they turn into a club.
Got it.
My dad built his as a club.
So a real club.
It was a real club, but, it was definitely a blues club.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, that being said, I keep hearing about swamp blues.
Yes.
Tell us about, what is that? How does that differentiate?
Well, that differentiates because blues is a music that started in the Deep South, but in the Deep South, people didn't travel. Like, they didn't have interstate and everyone went everywhere. So each area had its own sound. And so those who are really familiar with blues in the Baton Rouge blues area, you can kind of tell the musicians here have just a little bit of style in their music. So a lot of it is jumping blues, and then you got the long wailing blues, and that's the sound of swamp blues. But just me telling you that, it's really hard to hear. Mm-hmm. You almost have to really be a practiced listener to know, oh yeah, that's swamp blues.
So it's nuances then. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Interesting. Well, tell us a little bit more about juke joints and the history of juke joints.
Well, the history of juke joints came about because, I mean, here there has been Reconstruction that has ended. So those who had been released from slavery after Reconstruction ended, and then the Jim Crow laws came in that restricted the movement and the access that those who were former slaves and descendants of slaves were restricted as to where they could move. And their lives are very hard because they did not have access to institutions to move around America like they wanted to. So in trying to express the hard times, it wasn't always safe to talk. So the song seemed to be a good way to talk in code. And so you hear, when you hear other people listen to the blues, you will sometimes hear them say, sing the blues, which is saying, yes, you're right. I know what you're talking about. So in code, this music was music that expressed the pain and the frustration, and it was also music that relieved the pain and the frustration.
So cathartic.
Yeah, and like you might see some of them just playing acoustic guitar, just blowing harmonica outside, and it's almost like they're just singing to the heavens, like, you know, what am I doing here? I need y'all to know what I'm going through. And so even though the blues is about hard times, it makes them feel good. So it makes everybody feel good. It's a way to deal with the hard times and a way to express and protest.
And how about the instruments? Are there some specific instruments that are...
They play whatever. You know, they would play washtubs. They would play harmonica, which cost about $1 in the height of the blues. And it was a mouth organ. And it could make sounds that you just didn't think could come out of that instrument. And the guitar... the acoustic guitar, until someone finally electrified it and started recording it. But it was the instruments, all of it just came about as work with what you got.
The necessity, yeah.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about you. So you went to university here?
Yes, LSU.
And what was your major?
I majored in office administration because I went to college just to go to college,
right,
to get an education, because that was in the 60s. That was when LSU had first been forced to desegregate through a local lawsuit.
That being said, somebody told me that you were a real pioneer.
Yeah,
at
as
that
it turns
time.
Out.
Little did you know.
Yeah.
You were the first black female in the student
in
housing.
Women's housing, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then it gets better. In your on-air presence as a presenter, you were a trailblazer there, too.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, when I was working in radio, and as they told you, I was the first woman DJ in Baton Rouge and then the first black woman DJ at a station that was predominantly white. And from there, Channel 9 wanted to hire an African-American reporter, but they wanted one with experience. And the only experience I had was radio. So I learned on the job.
Are you still doing any
media
journalism?
No, I'm not doing media right now. I have a prospect of someone call me recently to talk to me, so I may be back in television. Not news, though.
Yeah. What I see is you doing some awesome documentaries.
Oh, that's a possibility.
That's a great one.
Yeah.
Tell us about your family and your mom and dad. What did they do?
My parents were both born on the bayou and lived on a bayou from birth to death. They were both Catholic, in the South, Catholics marry Catholics as much as possible. And my dad, as you know, we're descendants of the enslaved people that were sold to Louisiana by the Jesuits from Georgetown. So that's how that side got here. My mother's side of the family, her father's father was white and her mother was mostly white. His mother was mostly white. And then my grandmother, the same thing. And so they were heritage from, my grandfather's heritage was from the plantation, Nottoway. And I don't know on my grandmother's side quite his connection, but I know it was still in Iberville Parish.
So it's interesting in that here we are in Baton Rouge, modern city, and yet it has this historic tentacles that go way back.
You say that well, because that's just now starting to come up for more of a celebration. Like when we started the Blues Foundation in 2000, I think, it was because we saw that blues was not having enough attention here, and we wanted to preserve and promote and expand it because it has its roots here. Not necessarily directly in Baton Rouge, but from the surrounding areas, those bayou areas that are around Baton Rouge, the River City. And so along the river were where these plantations were, and this is where the people who had been from these plantations lived in these stressed areas, and so that's where the blues was evolved. Baton Rouge gave it a home because they had more money to spend to have the musicians play here. So a lot of the music came here, and then it was easy for those who had a bent toward blues, for the young people to start playing the blues as well. But blues was driven out of the United States. That's something people don't...
Oh, yeah.
That is so shocking to people to hear.
Fascinating story.
Yeah.
Tell us about how it was like the Merchant Mariners. Somebody was saying that these guys from England and whatnot would come in on ships and buy the records and bring them back to England and whatnot. And
yes.
And it became real popular there.
That's right. You know, it was driven out because of the powers that be said it was unsophisticated music and not fit for young people to hear.
Really? So it was an intentional...
Oh, definitely intentional. No, it was not. It didn't leave. It was driven out.
And what period of time was this?
This was before the 60s. This was in the mid, at the height of blues era. In the 50s, when it was starting to move across the country to Chicago, to Memphis, and places like that.
It was literally suppressed here.
It was driven out of the United States. It wasn't so much suppressed in the South, but as the South wanted to do business with those areas that didn't want blues, then it got quieted here, too.
Right, right. Interesting.
Yes. Economic reasons. Mm-hmm.
So, that's really fascinating.
Yeah.
But then it kind of was a boomerang effect.
Yes. When it went, the young people in England, in particular, who started recording it, like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Eric Clapton and people like that, their music became so popular, ended up getting tours here, and people say, well, where did you get this music from? And they said, from American bluesmen. And they said, we thought they were dead. People would say, we thought they were dead. So then when they started hearing this music, then they went to find them and bring them out again. And so many of them had resurgent careers like B.B. King and Muddy Waters and people like that.
That's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I feel like I've got to let you go. It's getting late.
Yeah, I think this is the last song.
Yep. Thank you so much for sharing.
My pleasure. I'm Maxine Crump, and right now I'm CEO of Dialogue on Race Louisiana.
People can learn more about what you're
absolutely
doing there. That's awesome.
And we're available to anyone, anywhere in the country.
All right. Thanks so much.
All right. You're welcome.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We'll see you down there.
My name is Kim Newstrom, and I'm the executive director of the Baton Rouge Blues Foundation, which presents the annual Blues Festival.
So was it the brainstorm of the foundation members that came up with the idea of doing the festival?
So actually, it was the reverse. So I'll tell you what happened. 25 years ago, a core group of people got together and said, we would like to start a blues festival. They started it at Southern University, actually. They had it there for a couple years and then moved it into downtown Baton Rouge. And each year as the festival has grown, after maybe 5 to 7 years, it was decided the most effective and efficient thing for the festival to do is to form a 501c3 nonprofit, a foundation, so that way you can apply for grants and, you know, get supporters and investors that are interested in having a year-round charitable presence.
So it started
as a festival, evolved into a foundation. So now there's an entire board of directors that sort of oversees and manages the foundation, and I am their first employee that they've ever had.
Wow.
So I was hired back in October, and I think the idea is that after 25 years, the festival and the nonprofit are at a a crossroads of really being able to propel itself into even more growth. So that's what their mission is right now, really looking at growth and sustainability of the foundation and thus the festival.
Every year it's the same weekend?
You know, it's sort of evolved and changed, and they've had to look at other festivals that happen. You know, Louisiana is a really big festival
so
state.
So you don't have conflict, yeah.
Right. For example, French Quarter Festival is happening this weekend in New Orleans, and that would be a natural day trip or draw for a potential Baton Rouge Blues Festival goer. So next year we are actually moving our dates where it's not a conflicting festival.
That's a hard one.
Yeah, it is. But what we've done for next year, for 2020, we've looked at and discussed with other festivals when they're being held. So for somebody, let's say, that's traveling internationally, or a lot of Canadians will come down, you can come to Louisiana next year and do Festival International, French Quarter Fest, Baton Rouge Blues Festival, and then the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Fest.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's wonderful, and we feel like, again, April and May, springtime is a great festival season for Louisiana. It's not too awfully hot yet.
Oh my God, this is like ideal. This
it is
magic.
But look, this is going to turn on a dime.
Oh, I know.
Any day
I
now.
Know. But today, realtors could go out and sell.
Oh no, today was beautiful. Yes, this is perfect festival weather. Yes.
So how many people typically come to the festival over the period of the 2 days?
That's an interesting question for a festival, a free festival like Baton Rouge Blues Fest is,
because you don't have
because
tickets.
We're not selling tickets. We're not cordoned off where we're counting people as they're coming in. So really we have to look at things like merchandise sales, beverage sales, try and take some aerial crowd shots, maybe, you know, legal drone shots and things like that. But it's a little hard. I mean, we've looked at crowd estimates in the past, anywhere from 20 to 30,000, you know, and hoping upwards towards 50,000 in the future. You know, after 25 years, you know, we're looking for that type of growth for this festival.
And I've talked to people that come down from Canada, Michigan,
yeah.
Wisconsin, all over the place. It's not just Southerners.
No, and one of our goals also is to really do some marketing regionally. We'd love to be able to advertise to the Canadians and Europeans. Do we have that type of budget? Not yet. But we can look at places in our region like Atlanta, like Houston, like Little Rock that are, you know, just, you know, a little day trip away, and they'll come stay for a long weekend. And so we think we have a potential audience in drawing some people from that regional area.
And what I found to be really welcoming about Baton Rouge is its compactness. You can walk almost anywhere. And
yes.
There are, what, 4 or 5 hotels right within a block or two?
Yeah, I think there's even more hotels than that, actually.
Just right within a block,
yeah,
of the festival.
Yeah, it's a very walkable downtown area. It's welcoming. It's filled with great restaurants. And really, it's just a very, to your point, welcoming area. Very Southern and appealing, and then the blues, of course, that connects all of us, right? So the blues music that's featured with our festival is something that really does bind us all.
And this is a real specific type of blues.
Yes, we call it Louisiana Swamp Blues.
Yeah,
and there are so many musicians that were born and raised in the Baton Rouge area. And unfortunately, several of them had to leave the area to be successful if that's how they wanted to earn a living. And Buddy Guy's a prime example of somebody who was born and raised in Letsworth, Louisiana, and now is in Chicago and comes home and has come and played the Blues Festival. But I have to say that is a loss for our state when we see these talented musicians have to go elsewhere at times to make a living.
Tell us more.
Well, this year our festival is a tribute to Lazy Lester, who was a Baton Rouge born and raised musician and pretty much stayed local for most of his career. And he passed away back during the summer. And so a lot of our featured performers this year will be doing Lazy Lester covers. We'll have some of his family members there doing a sort of tribute to Lazy as well, and give them, you know, a commemorative poster which actually features Lazy. And so that's something a little different this year. And last year, the featured performer was Henry Gray, who's playing at this event here tonight.
And that's who we heard in the background.
Yes, exactly. And he's a very well-known Baton Rouge musician, but plays all over as well. And he's in his early 90s, and he just I think he used to play at the Piccadilly Cafeteria here in Baton Rouge. I've talked to many people that said they remember growing up and seeing him play at Piccadilly. But he's got standing gigs at different little blues places all over town, and he's just a tried and true blues staple for Baton Rouge.
Wonderful music.
Yes, it's the blues.
For further information,
you can find us at BatonRougeBluesFestival.org, and then also BatonRougeBluesFoundation.org. And we have social media channels, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and things like that. My name is Kim Newstrom, again, the executive director of the Baton Rouge Blues Foundation, which presents the Blues Festival every year.
All right, Kim, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
Bill Bryan, and you are on the board of directors of the
Baton Rouge Blues Foundation.
You're born and raised local here, right?
I am. Grew up here. Actually, I kind of grew up in that era when we were still having some segregation, so I understood the differences and how a lot of this current blues came to be. So it was an interesting time to grow up here in Baton Rouge.
And I remember you talking earlier, you didn't care. You would go to these juke joints and whatnot.
I loved it. My mother's family is Sicilian. I don't think they really cared too much about whether you were black or white. You know, it was just whether you could do the job.
Right.
And that's kind of how I looked at music, you know. You wanted to put a band together, you got people who could perform. You know, a lot of people that I grew up with that were white kind of frowned upon associating with somebody who wasn't white. But, you know, everybody applauded our band because we were able to get some good musicians.
And you played saxophone, is that right?
I did. Played woodwinds, a little keyboards. When I was growing up, it was mostly guitar, bass, drums, a little keyboard. Woodwinds kind of had gone, they were real popular in the 50s, kind of dropped out in the 60s and the 70s, and then they're making a big resurrection now. It was a good versatile instrument where you can play obviously a lot of jazz, but you can also, you know, play with some blues and some rock, and so it was fun.
Talk to us about the Blues Festival and what's closest to your heart and what you're most proud of.
Most proud of the fact that our festival is now a two-day, I can say, internationally acclaimed festival. We have people from Australia, Europe, that make the trek every year to our festival. The festival actually began in 1981. It was just a group of African-American blues musicians who played up Southern University. It was just sort of a Saturday afternoon event. It went on for probably about 7-8 years, and then it just kind of died out. And then we resurrected it back in 2004. It was a sort of a Saturday afternoon event. We kept plugging along and getting bigger acts, attracting more people. You know, now 15 years later, it's a two-day festival getting 30, 40,000 people.
That's really cool. And it's every April, is that when it happens?
It is. There's a lot to be said for having an outdoor festival. People talk about an outdoor festival, but we were rained out one year and we had to move it indoors. We were able to salvage the festival, but you can definitely tell the difference between an outdoor festival and then moving an outdoor festival indoors. The ambiance is nowhere near the same. The whole vibe is different. Beer sales went down the drain. There's just something about an outdoor festival. You can't even move it indoors.
We talked earlier, there's a greater good component to the event in that the foundation takes some of the revenue they generate and they do some greater good music stuff with the schools. Tell us about that.
We do. This area has produced a lot of musicians that a lot of the community has no idea came from this area, and a lot of the music did not come from this area. So we're trying to encourage younger musicians to learn the blues, to appreciate the blues, and to play the blues. And so one of the things we do as a result of the festival is try to get with various school districts and see if we can incorporate a program or you know, maybe just have some kind of special event where we bring a blues musician into the school or bring the children to see a blues musician perform. Just something to
make that connection,
aware, make them aware, encourage them, and hopefully, you know, get them to start playing blues music.
That's really cool. Be able to learn more about the foundation.
The foundation started in 2002, and we began it basically as a result of understanding that there was no awareness, particularly in the white community, of these African-American blues musicians who came from here. So one of the things we wanted to do was to promote and preserve the music that came out of here and to encourage these younger people to play music and just let people know about the blues that came out of here. We have an indigenous kind of swamp blues that arose out of this area. Most people don't even know the blues, much less swamp blues. So it was a labor of love to educate the community on this kind of music. And now we have a couple of radio programs. We have a high school radio station here. So we have a couple of blues shows. And sometimes you just kind of have to get them two ears at a time. And you don't just go get a 1,000 people. You just get one person, four people, eight people. And so we're just slowly but surely increasing the awareness and, fortunately, the popularity of the blues.
Oh, I love it. And you have a website where somebody could learn more?
BatonRougeBluesFoundation.org. We have a BatonRougeBluesFestival.org has a website, and there's a link to our foundation website. And then the festival website has all the information about the festival and some of the collateral issues. So either one of those are good information stations.
Bill Bryan, what a pleasure.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thanks for coming.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We'll see you here.
Sometimes it's hard. It's hard to stay cool. Sometimes it's hard. It's hard to stay cool.
Be sure to stay tuned for the next Journeys of Discovery podcast from Baton Rouge, where we'll visit with local legend Lloyd Johnson Jr. He's the owner of Teddy's Juke Joint in rural Zachary, Louisiana. At one time, juke joints were typically just crudely decorated front rooms of a sharecropper's shack, where friends congregated to sing the blues, dance the night away, and down a pint or two. These havens for sharecroppers at one time dotted the rural countryside throughout the Deep South, but there are just a handful still operating today. Lloyd Johnson says one reason for the demise is that young people balk at paying a cover charge just to cover the cost of the band. Today, he's happy if he makes enough from beer sales to pay the utilities.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Singel, San Luis Obispo, California.
Yes, we did. Didn't have a toilet. Didn't have a bathroom. Walked 3 miles every day. To have water in the house for another day.